national award-winning program under which students from high schools are invited to come to the court, listen to an oral argument. They've been given materials about the case, and then they stay, and after the case is heard at about noon, a justice will meet with them and discuss the processes and procedures of this court. And so Oregon High School has been one of our faithful attendees year in and year out. Thank you. And they will meet this afternoon with Justice Bradley. We, of course, are delighted to have all our other guests here with us today. So let me introduce the court. On my far left is Justice Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Brooks. To my immediate left is Justice Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Babbage. To his right is Justice Bradley, with whom you'll meet, and on the far right is Justice Prosser. With those introductions made, I will call the second case, which is 01-0863FT, meaning Fast Track. And it's the Hyde Companies, Inc. versus Dove Healthcare. And arguing initially will be Robert K. Boltman, representing the Hyde Companies, doing business as Greenbrier Rehabilitation. Counsel.
Thank you. My name is Rob Boltman, and I'm here representing the Heidi Companies and its division, Greenbrier Rehabilitation. I'd like to start first by letting the court know, in my opinion, what this case is and what this case is not. This case, to me, is not an action to restrict employees. It's an action to enforce a contract. It's not an action to deny or to prevent an individual from earning a living. It's an action to require Dove to honor its commitment and fulfill its promise. Greenbrier performed its obligations under the contract with Dove and performed them well. This is not in dispute. What is in dispute and what this court should not excuse is Dove's attempt to avoid its obligations under the party's contract. Dove should be required to fulfill its commitment and honor its promise. This case is about a breach of contract. This court has said courts cannot allow the underlying policy of Section 103.465 and the relating rules of construction to overwhelm the focus of our analysis in what are, at their core, contract cases. We must necessarily focus on the individual contracts. I'd like the court, in this case particularly, to focus on the record. These are the trial court's words, not mine. Dove tries to hide behind the employees and claim that the contract was about taking advantage of these individuals who would be unable to freely market their hard-earned skills. The trial court correctly found that the employees were free to go and work wherever they choose, including Dove, provided that Dove honored its contract with Greenbrier. Excuse me.
As I understand it, these employees could go to Dove after a year without Dove having to pay anything.
That's correct.
And only if it was within that first year that did Dove have the right, or did Hyde or Greenbrier have the right to either tell them no or get 50% of their salary.
Correct.
One other question for asking. You're the therapist. The people who were involved were not aware of this provision in the contract, were they, when they were hired?
For the four employees that were awarded damage, you're correct. There was one employee that was initially part of the lawsuit, employee by the name of Mary Grace, and her testimony in the record is that she was told that there was some restriction. The exact extent of it, she didn't question.
Wouldn't that be important to say, all right, you're going to work for us, but just so you know, you're obligated to be here for X time, or if you do leave, you can go use, you know, what you've learned, our skills, and transfer from other institutions within this particular area?
Well, my position on that fact, Your Honor, is that the employees themselves are not restricted. The employees were free to go wherever they want, to work wherever they want.
Well, except here, this is in the La Crosse area. I think you've got about 35 total entities, so they were, I'm not, that may be beside the point, but it seems that this is an area in which they might have lived and thought in court.
Well, I think that's why the court needs to focus on the record and the facts of this particular claim. The record in this case does not support Dove's claim that its commitment with Greenbrier unfairly restricted these employees. There was no action in this case taken against any of the employees. There was no effort to prevent any of the employees from working at Dove or at any other facility. There was no actual harm to the employees in this case. In reality, when you look at the record, the employees were in fact hired by Dove. This case is really about Dove trying to avoid its contractual obligation to pay the fee that they agreed to pay as part of the negotiated contract.
That raises the question, is this under Section 103, whatever that is, the chapter on restrictive covenants, or is it under the State Sherman Act?
I think clearly it falls under the Sherman Act. Section 103.465, by its express terms, deals only with employment contracts between employees and employers. And in this case, what we're talking about is the enforceability of a contract between Dove and Greenbrier.
But won't you agree that indirectly this contract restricts the employability of these employees? Because anyone who is going to know about this is going to say, heck, I'm not going to hire these people because I have to pay 50% of their salaries. I have to therefore pay them 150%, 100 to the employee, 50 to the former employer, right? So I'm not going to hire them. I'm going to hire Z from out of town because it's only going to cost me 100%.
Theoretically, Your Honor, I would agree with you that in theory is something that could happen, but based on the record in this case, it did not happen because Dove stated in point fact that it was willing to pay that additional bonus to hire these specific people. And I think
so you'd have a different rule of law if a Dove hired from, if Dove refused to hire ABC, then it might come under the restrictive covenant statute. But if they hired D, E, and F, then it's a breach of contract.
No, I would not have a different rule of law. I still believe, my opinion, the statute on its face does not apply. I think that you have to go to the Sherman Act. I think some of the public policy behind the statute, whether it's an unreasonable restraint of trade, does apply, but the statute on its face doesn't. I think you need to go to the next step.
So why does it matter under unreasonable restraint of competition of unreasonable restraint of trade whether or not Dove hired these employees?
Well, I think it's point of fact that it's not an unreasonable restriction and under the facts of this particular case, because we're talking about theoretical harm to these employees. We're talking about a theoretical restraint. We're talking about a theoretical impediment to these people obtaining employment, when in reality, there was no impediment. They were hired. They were hired, and they're working at the facility where they chose to work. And they're doing that because Dove was willing to pay, as it acknowledged in its brief, it was willing to pay the fee even if this court is forcing them to honor their commitment, honor the promise that they made to us.
Would these terms, if contained in a covenant not to compete that had been entered into with the employees, have survived scrutiny in terms of the duration of the non-compete and the scope of it?
In my opinion, yes. I think it would have. Had the employees been restricted for 1 year, in Wisconsin, the law on restrictive covenants, it depends on the facts of each particular claim, obviously, but up to 2 years has been accepted, so I think 1 year is reasonable. The facility itself, it's limited to the facilities where Greenbrier provides services. These aren't people that are pigeonholed into one spot and never go anywhere else. Part of the reason for the restriction with the facilities as opposed to the employees is because these people do jump around. They're not put just at the Greenbrier employees were not just put at the Dove facility. They worked at the Dove facility and another facility. And that's fairly typical in my client's practice. So it made it easier to deal with the facilities as opposed to the employees. It would be more challenging to draft a restriction, I think, that would hold up, especially given the law and the intent of the legislator as enacted by 103465. It would probably be more difficult to enforce, but I think under the facts of this case, it would hold up.
Including the part that speaks to the prohibition against employment with any entity, even if the employee was never placed there. You know, as I understand, the breadth of the no hire position says it doesn't matter if you ever worked at Dove or any whichever. Contract entity we're referring to,
correct.
You can't work there.
Correct.
So if even that provision that says you can't, if it were translated into a covenant not to compete, a pure restricted covenant such that the statute did apply specifically, would that stand up?
I'm sure it would be the point of attack and challenge having litigated these cases. I mean, that's certainly the avenue that I would go. What a court would do with that, I don't know. I think it is an area that probably, if I had to point to the weakest part of that, if this was a covenant under 103.465, it would be that element of it. But that brings up another point.
Tell me what that element is, Ken.
Pardon me?
Tell me what the element is, since I'm having trouble hearing Justice Sykes.
The element that Justice Sykes
is
questioning, the restriction in the contract prohibits, if this were a restrictive covenant in the context of an employment, it would prohibit the employee from working at any facility where Greenbrier provided services, arguably even facilities where that particular employee had not been or had not provided services. And that's the element that Justice Sykes is, I think, pointing out may cause trouble under analysis under 103.465.
Why doesn't it also cause trouble under the analysis of 133.03? You still have, as I understand the law, the same kind of time, place, purpose, and scope inquiry in order to determine whether or not the contract is in restraint of trade. Why isn't the argument that the scope of this provision is too broad because it covers people who are part of Greenbrier but have never worked at Dove? Can you respond to that?
Because the legislature, in enacting section 103.465, has indicated that if one part of a restriction is unenforceable, the entire part, even those parts that are reasonable, is thrown out. Having litigated restrictive covenant cases, what you try to do is find one part that's unreasonable, because then the courts are obligated under that statute to throw the whole thing out. I don't think that that's the law under the common law or under the Sherman, under Section 133. I think you revert back to the common law before the enactment of 103.465, which does allow what the court refers to as blue penciling. And here, again, to draw the court back to the record of this case, these employees didn't go to some far-flung facility that they hadn't been serving. They went to the exact same facility where they were working, except they're not working for us anymore, they're working for Dove directly. So I think if you don't have that restriction that's placed specifically in 103.465, that specifically relates only to contracts between employers and employees, if the court finds that that restriction is unreasonable, you could make that as a ruling, and it wouldn't affect, I think, the factual nature of this particular claim.
Mr. Bowman, weren't there several of these employees that had not worked for Dove before?
No.
They all had been at Dove?
The only person who was not actually at the Dove facility out of the four people that we're talking about is, I'm forgetting his name now. The person that they hired as Dave Millard, that they hired as the rehabilitation director, he had not worked specifically in the Dove facility prior to accepting an employment offer directly from Dove. But he had worked at other facilities, I think, where the Dove employees, the other Greenbrier employees had worked. So he had contact with these employees. He had knowledge of them. And then he also started working at the Dove facility in November and worked with the Greenbrier staff for a month before these people actually left. So he was able to observe them daily in their work routine and was able to, I think as the court reflected, cherry pick the best therapist. And when you look at the trial court decision, he picked an occupational therapist, he picked a physical therapist, and he picked speech-language pathologist, actually two, because they were job-sharing. So Mr. Millard was the only one of the four that we are seeking damages for and that the trial court awarded damages for that wasn't at the facility, but he had access to the employees and had knowledge of them. And I think, again, if you look at the record, to further follow up on that point, if you look at the record, there is some talk of the employees about why they wanted to leave Greenbrier, and I think that it's clear from the record, it didn't come out directly, but I think it's clear from the record that these people knew each other based on some of the common inferences and things that they're talking about.
Mr. Bolton, I think you would concede that this non-compete clause certainly had impact on the employees, isn't that correct?
In this particular case, based on the record, no. Could it have an effect? Yes.
Okay. It could have an effect. Why? What would be wrong with this court simply saying that when you're going to have this kind of an effect on employees, the agreement must be between Greenbrier and the employees, not between Greenbrier and Dove?
I think the court is robbing businesses of the right to freely contract and come to terms with each other. This court has said that the party should be free to contract unless is it against the public policy of the state. And based on all of the arguments that we can make in this case and that I've made in my briefs, I don't think that the restriction that is there is an unreasonable restriction, and I don't think it unfairly restricts these employees.
Let's turn it around. Suppose this was a contract between the employees and the employer, and it said, "You, if you work for anyone with whom we've placed you, and you work for them instead of for us, within a year after our relation is terminated, you have to give, you, the employee, have to give me, the employer, one half of your annual salary. Right?
Okay.
Would that be a valid restrictive covenant, or would it fall under the same thing? Limited geographical area, let's say. I'm going to make it really favorable to the employer. Limited time. The only thing is a liquidated one half.
Well, I guess I would have to add some additional facts to your hypothetical.
Okay.
If the employee was paid a premium and had negotiated that as part of the contract going into it and said, I will accept a position from you and I will accept this as compensation from you, and in exchange for that I give you my commitment and promise that this is what I will do if I violate my agreement with you, then yes, I think it is reasonable and I think it is enforceable.
You don't think it's oppressive to say you pay us half your salary?
Not if you were fairly compensated for that promise on the front end of your agreement. I think the parties should be free to contract. And in hindsight, in looking at it, if you're talking about someone who was making minimum wage and that was the agreement that they had, then potentially that could be oppressive. But I think you have to add the facts here and to convert that to the case that we're talking about. Dove negotiated this contract with Greenbrier. Greenbrier went into this contract based on the assumption that it would have the protections that it negotiated in this contract. If Dove had told them on the front end of this, we have no intention of honoring our commitment to you, we have no intention of following through on this, we never would have placed our employees there. They're our assets. They're our only assets. We're a service corporation. And without those assets, there's no point in being in business.
Contracting that are affected by this, the employees had no knowledge or notice of that. In other words, they didn't know when they worked for Greenbrier and or Dove that they were restricted. They didn't. These are the people that are affected most by this agreement. You're saying you have two companies that can get together and negotiate terms, but that those terms should or would or in this case, we're not known to the professional employees. These are people that have these very individual and specific skills.
There are a lot of contracts where you have an incidental effect or impact on third parties. Take, for instance, a restrictive covenant between a physician and his employer. If it's a large medical practice. And the physician has a restrictive covenant that would fill in the hypothetical as otherwise enforceable, that says that that physician won't continue to see these patients when he leaves. I think this court would enforce that type of agreement.
Sure.
Would those patients who are indirectly affected by this...
Yeah. We're in, like, in Wasaki, where the new... The clients, they got them from the employer. I agree with that. But I'm talking, this is to me, and you can explain it otherwise, seems to be different. These people don't know who they're going to treat. I'm talking about these people, the employer, the employees, and they go to work, and then for whatever reason, they decide that they want to work some other place. All of a sudden they're saying, no, you can't, because we signed an agreement that says you can't work in this place and 34 other places.
If the contract said that they couldn't work there, I would agree with you. But the contract doesn't say that. I don't think that I can bind a third party to a contract that they're not a party to. The question isn't whether or not these employees are not able to work again. I don't think I could enter into an agreement with Dove that would say these people can never be hired as physical, occupational, or speech pathologists again. But that's not what the contract says.
It says that they can't work there for a year in that capacity.
No, it says they can't work there for a year in that capacity unless they ask our permission which will give, these are at-will employees, and they pay the fee that they talked about and agreed to as part of their contract.
Well, it seems to me that Greenbrier does have something to protect here. In other words, they're providing the training, etc. And so they are entitled to any reasonable means to protect their investment. We allow that. We allow non-compete clauses in many instances. But here, their means of protection involves an unknowledgeable party. If they want to be straight and above board about this, shouldn't they have to go to the employee and say, look, we'll train you, but in exchange for that, you have to work for us for a year. Or you have to stay under contract, and if you try to go someplace else, you're going to have to pay us for that training. That seems to me to be far more above board than what was done here.
I would agree under that hypothetical, but again, that's not what this contract says. This contract does not say that these people have to stay with us for a year. This contract does not say that these people have to pay us any fee. This is a contract between Greenbrier and
Dove. Well, you say it doesn't say that. Certainly, literally, it does not say that. But as the chief pointed out, what it says to the other employer is, if you use these people, you're going to have to pay 150% of their salary as opposed to 100%. So, I mean,
but that's something that the parties freely negotiated on the front end of the contract.
Dove and Greenbrier negotiated, but the employees didn't.
But under the facts of this case, this agreement did not affect the employees. They were hired by Dove.
That gets back to the initial question. If you keep saying that they're not affected, then you're saying this is a moot case because no one's affected here.
Well, Greenbrier's affected because we haven't gotten our money.
But the employees are not affected, so you've got to wipe them out of the equation. So I said, okay, I'm going to wipe them out of the equation. Then suppose you had another case where the employee is affected, because the new employer says, no, I'm not taking yet 150%, and I don't want a lawsuit, forget it, right? And I said to you, you're going to have a different rule for that case than you are going to have in this case, and your response was, no. Okay, so we can't keep coming back to the employees here are not affected. You have to assume the worst-case scenario, that the employees are affected.
Well, if you assume that the employees are affected, that's not the test. The test isn't whether or not they're affected. The test is whether they're unreasonably restricted.
Okay.
And again, I apologize for continuing to argue the facts of this case. That's what I know best. But when you get to the law here, the law also says that in order to be an unreasonable restriction and therefore unenforceable, in order for the restriction to be unenforceable, it has to be unreasonable. And here, I do not believe that the restriction is unreasonable. You talk about the hypothetical that nobody would pay a bounty or an additional fee to hire these employees. Well, I think that would greatly disappoint all of the employment agencies in the state and headhunters who make their living by collecting just such a fee. Again, this is something where you look at it, and the restriction that's there is a freely negotiated restriction between two sophisticated businesses who entered into a contract under certain assumptions. And the basic assumptions being that each one of them were going to follow through and honor the commitments that they made to each other.
Do we know what percentage of the physical therapy market Greenbrier occupies in this area?
Well, and I'd like to point to the record about that, and specifically, I think it's somewhat misleading the way it has been presented. Greenbrier, we're talking specifically about the Chippewa Falls-Eau Claire area. Greenbrier fills 33 positions out of a total of 273. That's 12% of the available positions. But again, in the theory being asserted by Dove is that because of that, it's an unreasonable restriction. You're taking 12% out of of the available market out. But out of those 33 positions, we're really talking about 8 facilities. If you look at Trial Exhibit 39, it lists the facilities, and Trial Exhibit 37. You're talking about 33 positions in 8 facilities. One of those facilities is Dove. 2 of the other facilities out of the 8 are Greenbrier facilities. So when you're looking at, you're talking about a total of 8 facilities. If they're quitting working for us, I assume they're not going to work at the 2 Greenbrier facilities. So now you're down to 6, including Dove, the facility that they were at. So really you're talking about 5 other facilities where these people, where the facilities would have to pay some kind of additional fee to hire these employees.
Out of how many total potential employers does the record speak to that?
The record, yeah, I didn't look at that. But it is in the record. If you look at Exhibit 39, there's a listing of all of the facilities, the total facilities in the Eau Claire Chippewa Falls. Region. When they're talking before, the record does talk about 35 total facilities that Dove has contracts with, but those 35 facilities are spread throughout northern Wisconsin. There are a number of them in Shawano. There are a number of them Clintonville over in that area towards Green Bay. I won't profess to know every little town that's mentioned there, but the point being, when you look at Exhibit 39, that there are only 8 facilities really in the Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire area, which is what we're talking about. Another point not to lose sight of in the record is that one of these employees, when we're talking about it being unfairly restrictive to the employee, is that one of the employees was going to the Racine area. So to say that they're limited in the Chippewa Falls or Eau Claire area, I think is a little bit misleading when these employees are free to go elsewhere.
Thank you, Council. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Dittmer, representing Dove Healthcare.
May I please record, Council? My name is Carol Dittmer. I'm with the Garvey Anderson firm from Eau Claire, and I do represent Dove Healthcare in this action. I was going to start my argument stating that Greenbrier would have us put the blinders on, that we should not take a look at the effect on the employees. As I understand it, in the conversation between my opposing counsel and Chief Justice Abrahamson, there's at least been a recognition that employees are affected by this provision, regardless of the continual commentary that they are not affected. In addition, I do want to clear up a point. Dove never agreed to pay this, what we've called a bounty, or this higher fee, so to speak. Dove knew it was taking a risk, but it never agreed to pay this fee. And in fact, what it ended up as a defendant in a lawsuit. And here we are in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court as a result of this contractual provision. Counsel, you make the clarification and the argument that, of course, the employees are affected. Well, if there was no provision with regard to hiring, that is, there was the absence of a no-hire provision, but the provision was, if you're going to hire our temporary help that we place, you're going to have to pay a premium of the first 50% of the first 6 months' wages. Is that a reasonable provision?
I submit it is not, Justice Bradley, and in response to a question from Justice Sykes, my opposing counsel said that if this was a non-compete, and we were analyzing it under 103.465, that it would pass muster. I take the decidedly opposite view.
Well, my concern is temporary help companies. The only thing they market is the people that they provide. That is, they've interviewed them, they've gone through all sorts of efforts that have not had to be done by Dove.
I think of my experience in the law office. On occasion, we had to have temporary legal assistants or secretaries, came from an employment agency, and there's a provision in the agreement that, hey, if you hire this temporary help out from under us after we did the grooming and we found people in a hard-to-find employment area and we provided a well-trained person to you, that there's something you have to pay. That sounds reasonable to me.
It does. And there's two differences between the scenario that you just provided and the case that we have in front of us today. First of all, notice. Everybody going into that agreement with a temporary help agency, Manpower gives you a legal temp for a while, knows that, including the employee, that if they are eventually hired, there's going to be a higher fee, shall we say. The employee knows that.
I don't know that the employee knows that. They do. I mean, I think it was Manpower that we probably used. I don't know if the employee knew what was in the contract between myself and Manpower.
All right. Well, I guess we're going to be in a situation where we're speculating about what the contracts with Manpower indicate. In addition, under these 103-465 cases, the employer has to establish that the protection or the no-compete is reasonably necessary for the employer, that the employer would suffer some damages. In your scenario, you stated that the agency went out and recruited these people and incurred expenses. They trained them, et cetera, and that's what they're getting paid for by putting these people in the employ of a legal firm or partnership or agency. But there's no proof in this record that Greenbrier is going to experience any damages. That goes to one of my secondary arguments about the liquidated damages provision in the event they are hired.
Is any premium paid by an entity like Dove when they hire temporary help supplied by an entity like Greenbrier? Is any provision regarding premium unreasonable?
Never say never. If indeed they can establish damages that it's reasonably necessary for the protection, I believe an argument could be made. But again, these are at-will employees. They are not indentured servants. Greenbrier doesn't own these people. And what they are essentially, by entering into a contract of this nature with Dove, they're stating that these employees are worth so much to us, Dove, that you've got to pay us this higher fee.
Won't your argument, if you're not willing to even concede that mouse, some premium might be reasonable, doesn't your argument end up in putting these temporary help places out of business?
No. First of all, because if the employer can establish that they did incur these expenses, these recruitment expenses, so to speak, then they are entitled to a fee. However, here there is no evidence in this record whatsoever that Greenbrier experienced actual or would experience actual damages as a result of their at-will employees going to another employer. In fact, in the one of the cases relied on by the appellate court, the California case, the Webb case, that was a case where the California court found that the temporary placement agency was entitled to the placement fee because of the recruitment expenses that it had incurred in placing these particular individuals. And there was no such proof in these records. These individuals were simply at-will employees. Are we going to say that the law in the state of Wisconsin is that we can no longer recruit at-will employees or suffer damages as a result of hiring them away from their existing employer?
Well, it seems to me that the proposition that you have to have damages before, or you have to have these expenses before you can recover, is really not as important as, at least to me, it's not as persuasive as the argument that when the employees are affected, they have a right to know. So what if this record did show that there were recruitment expenses or training expenses on behalf of Greenbrier? Let's get rid of the, you know, what your premise is. Let's say that the record does show that, or we presume that. Are you saying then that this non-compete provision, for lack of a better word, is still okay, or are you saying that it still must require knowledge of the employee?
It still must require knowledge of the employee. That's the first inquiry. And my reading of the appellate court decision indicates that that is the issue they had the most difficulty with. And in fact, they concluded, last paragraph, that their decision is because of the lack of notice that this provision was going to be against public policy under the laws of the state of Wisconsin as the appellate court was interpreting it.
Ms. Stedler, were any of the employees parties to this action?
They were not.
How would you handle an argument that if Dove is going to rely on a provision such as this as a defense to paying these damages, that the employees themselves are either necessary or indispensable parties and should have been part of this action?
Justice Crooks, because a provision of a contract is either going to be against public policy or it isn't. It doesn't depend whether that particular provision, the no-hire provision, is against public policy. It's not dependent on whether these particular individuals were named as parties in this action.
So even though Dove is relying on this particular provision to claim that it's an unenforceable contract, still the employees are not essential, they're not necessary or indispensable parties?
That's correct, and if they were added as individual parties, I could anticipate the argument that they suffered no damages, so what are they doing here? Some kind of a catch-22 situation. Again, I go back to, we take a look at the provision of this particular contract, is it against public policy or isn't it? Now, to make that determination, we have to necessarily go outside the terms of the contract and look at the reality of it. And how is it affecting individuals? And that's what the appellate court did, and I submit that that's the correct analysis.
Well, another way of stating this is that you are writing on the back of a contract that is contrary to public policy against the employees. There's nothing inherent in the public policy to say that you shouldn't pay a finder's fee, right?
I know of no public policy against finder's fee.
So all this contract is between you and the Hyde Company, the Greenbrier, is an arrangement for a finder's fee. And even if it's a large amount of money, 50% or was 100% finder fee or 150% finder fee, you're a big company. You can make your own deal. And if you want to pay too much, it's okay. And the only reason that you're arguing that this is a invalid contract is not because it's invalid in public policy to you, but that it's invalid to third persons. And why can't we say, no, you have to look at invalidity of the contract between the contracting parties, not its effect on third parties?
That is certainly one position that this court could take, and it's certainly a position that was in my opposing counsel's brief. I submit that's the wrong position to take, however, that this particular contract does indeed affect the rights of individuals to access the workforce, a right that Wisconsin courts have found basic. Any restrictions on the ability to make a livelihood are carefully scrutinized and are made to pass muster under 103.465. This is de facto, Chief Justice, a covenant not to compete that the employees did not even know about.
Well, you're arguing under 103.465. What about 103.03?
The Sherman Act statute as well. I believe that's applicable as well, and as the appellate court did, and found that the public policy that's found in both of those statutes, 133 and 103.465, indicates that contracts of this nature are not to be honored in the state of Wisconsin because it affects the ability of the employees to seek employment, and not only that, they had no knowledge of it.
Now, in Sherman Act, you have to find damages, though, right?
Correct.
And your opponent keeps saying, hey, there are no damages here. These employees were paid and they have jobs. Your argument has to be, it seems to me, to overcome that other employees might not find it so easy to find jobs.
That's correct.
Well, that's a hypothetical.
That's correct. And I would also, there was some discussion about what the proper market area or the region was and to determine whether there was an anti-competitive effect as a result of this agreement, and by no means was that issue clearly addressed in the trial court. And at no time did Dove ever agree that the applicable market is simply the Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls area. As Justice Crooks pointed out, there was evidence in the record that there were at least 33, if not 35, other facilities with whom Greenbrier had contracted, which had similar provisions, which would also mean that these employees were not only just prevented from working at Dove, assuming Dove wouldn't pay the fee, and or assuming Greenbrier didn't give permission, they were also prevented from working at these 33 or 35 other facilities as well.
Why did you ever agree to that provision if it's so horrible?
I cannot dispute the fact that we've got two sophisticated parties who entered into this contract.
That's what comes to my mind. If this is such a dastardly deed to engage for Greenbrier to have this provision, well, it's just as dastardly for you, isn't it?
Yeah, Justice Bradley, I reviewed that issue as well before coming down here today. The parties entered into a contract, one of the terms of which violates public policy. That's our argument, is that it violates public policy.
So why should they suffer and not you?
Pardon?
Why should they suffer? I mean, I'm just, you know, arguing.
Why should Greenbrier suffer and
That's,
not us?
I mean, if I take as your correct as your premise that this is just a horrible, un-American provision, you are a sophisticated entity, as they are. You made this contractual agreement. Why now should you be able to say, oh, that was an awful provision. It's illegal. It's irresponsible. It's immoral. And now, but we agreed to it. You know what I mean? So how do you respond to that?
And I think I touched on that briefly in response to a question from Justice Crooks, is if a contract is against public policy, if a provision is against public policy, it's against public policy. Did we agree to a provision which we are now asserting is against public policy? Yes. we did. Are we two sophisticated entities that entered into a contract? Yes, we are. But we now have a provision which we assert affects at-will employees and improperly limits their access to the workforce. And those are the individuals that we are focusing on, as Chief Justice Abrahamson indicated, that are we riding the back or riding the coattails of individuals who are not a direct party to this contract? Yes, we are.
Well, why don't you just confess liability under the contract?
I'm just arguing this.
Why don't you just confess liability under the contract, the dollar damages, and then there wouldn't be any problem with regard to hiring them, right?
Well, we also want to take a look out or protect these employees and against future contracts of this nature. This particular issue has never been decided by a Wisconsin court, whether no hire provisions are going to be valid under Wisconsin law, and if they are, under what scrutiny are they going to be held.
And so Dove wants to take this on as a esoteric issue.
My attorney's fees are being paid, Justice Bradley, I can tell you that much.
Okay. Let me ask, are no-hire provisions commonplace in the market?
I know, Justice Prosser, I don't know that I have enough experience to answer whether they are common. I can have other courts dealt with the issues. Yes, we've got the case in California that I referred to. We had
have you encountered them in Wisconsin?
I have not personally encountered them, but again, I don't want to give the wrong impression that I am some great authority on this subject.
I'd like to ask about the consent provision in the no-hire agreement. Opposing counsel seems to say, yes, there's a consent provision there, but it's of no consequence. Just kind of ignore it because we give consent. What would you say?
Well, I made note of that as well in my notes. That's a bit after the fact. There is a provision which indicates that they have to give consent, and it isn't automatic, and if indeed he indicated that it wasn't no account, why is it in there?
Was it valid in your view? Is that an objectionable provision?
It's a restraint on the employee's ability to seek employment elsewhere. So I would submit that that provision would also have to be construed and would have to pass muster either under 103.465 or the State Anti-Sherman Act. Is it reasonably necessary for the protection of the employer? Which goes back to the question again that was posited by Justice Sykes. With this, if it was just a straight out covenant not to compete, that the employees agreed with Greenbrier that they would not seek employment at facilities they had worked at while in Greenbrier employ. It's a flat-out covenant not to compete. Would that pass muster? It would not, especially under the published appellate opinions that came out last summer. One of them is Brass, and I believe the other one is Mutual Service, which indicated that if the provision is overbroad in any detail, and that's contained within the wording of the statute itself, the covenant not to compete is unenforceable.
The lower courts didn't engage in any of that analysis, did they?
They did not. In fact, the circuit court judge completely indicated that 103.465 does not apply, period.
And yet the Court of Appeals based its opinion that this contract violates 133.03 as an unreasonable restraint of trade based on its conclusion
that it is tantamount to a restrictive covenant under 103465 that doesn't pass muster, except it never evaluated whether it would pass muster.
It's a fair representation of what the appellate court, but the appellate court did not specifically state that this provision violated 103465. The appellate court stated that it violated the public policy that was embodied and found in 103465 and the state anti-Sherman statute.
Well, it did that as sort of a theoretical matter rather than a real matter, as I read the opinion, and I think that's what we're all here to discuss, is whether this is an unreasonable restraint of trade as merely a theoretical matter, or is it real?
Right.
I mean, it seems to me that, yes, as a theoretical matter, a no-hire provision burdens the mobility of the employees, and the question is to what extent, you know, and is that extent unreasonable for purposes of the Little Sherman Act?
That and the initial question is also, did the employee have notice? Did the employee even have any idea that this no-hire provision was out there?
Why should that matter? Because this is a contract between two commercial entities,
right.
And we're not talking about a restrictive covenant in an employment contract.
But Justice Sykes, if I go to work for somebody, and that individual, especially as an at-will employee, and that entity has contracts with other entities which prevent me from being hired by those other entities.
Well, it doesn't prevent; it just burdens.
Okay,
it puts a price on it.
It certainly puts a chilling effect on my employability by other entities. I want to know that. I want to know that before I accept employment at that entity.
Your argument is the lack of knowledge or the lack of participation on the part of the employee is their lack of notice and knowledge is per se unreasonable.
I would submit that is and should be the rule of law in the state of Wisconsin. The appellate court so concluded in the last paragraph of its opinion. The appellate court states, we conclude that an employee's individual right and freedom to contract may not be restricted by a contract between two employers unless the employee is aware of and consents to the contract. Greenbrier could have just had these individuals enter into non-compete agreements. And then we'd be up at a 103465 analysis, whether it's reasonable and reasonably necessary for the protection of the employer. And for whatever reason they did not do that, I submit that one of the reasons they didn't do that is because such an agreement would never pass muster under 103465. So they're trying to backdoor into these non-compete situations with this no-hire provision with the entities with whom they provide services.
Ms. Dittmer, isn't the consent of the employee extremely important? When you read the provision from the Court of Appeals, they weren't just talking about knowledge, they were talking about consent. It just strikes me that of the two, that perhaps the consent by the employee is the more important aspect.
You're right, Justice, and I misspoke if I meant to indicate that all they needed to do was have knowledge. They'd have knowledge and consent to the existence of these particular contracts.
Well, why is the consent of the employee important? You've consented, and yet you're fighting it.
Because
the employee consents, why can't it fight it?
Yeah, but because the employee is never given the option under the facts of this case. The employee could come in, fill out an application, and in fact, one of the employees in this particular case at the time of their application with Greenbrier asked, is there going to be any non-competes that I have to fill out? And the answer was no. Now, if I fill out an application and I'm told, hey, by the way, we've got these no-hire clauses with 35 other facilities, then I can make the determination or the decision to say no. I don't want to subject myself to that. And these employees were never given that alternative or option.
Does Greenbrier have any other mechanism to protect its interests other than a non-compete clause with employees?
I'm not aware of any other vehicle or mechanism that Greenbrier could use other than a non-compete clause with its employees. But if one reads the Densmore case, the South Dakota case, which the appellate court relied upon, they determined that in order for these provisions to be enforceable, they had to be accompanied with non-competes that are filed or that are signed by the particular employee in question. Now, I don't know if the court needs to embroil itself in the details of the mechanisms of knowledge and consent, but that would certainly be one way within which that sort of knowledge and consent could be documented.
Suppose instead of a 50% payment, it was a 5% payment here.
In Densmore.
Pardon me? In this case.
Would
you be arguing that that's an unreasonable restraint of trade because the employee did not know and consent?
The knowledge and consent, the issue would be the extent that that sort of a payment prohibited or affected the employee's ability to access the workforce. So would a 5% have as chilling effect on that access factor as 50% would be? Obviously the answer is no, it wouldn't. I believe the analysis needs to be the same. Is it reasonably necessary for the protection of the employer? So, Your Honors, as I indicated some minutes earlier, these were at-will employees that were subjected to de facto non-compete agreements that they had no knowledge of. Under those facts, this contractual provision cannot stand. It is void as a matter of public policy. That is the decision and the finding of the appellate court, and I ask that this court so hold.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Boltman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Could I ask you how prevalent these non-hire provisions are throughout the country and in Wisconsin?
Based on my research and based on my knowledge, I think that they are fairly typical. They're fairly typical in service industries, such as high-tech industries, employment agencies. Manpower is a good example. I think Justice Bradley talked about her employment in a law firm and using a placement agency to provide somebody. I've done hiring at our firm, and we have those same provisions in there.
Don't you tell the employee about the provisions? Doesn't Manpower tell the employee?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Is the 50%, is that normal? That seems like a pretty big chunk.
I can't speak as to what's normal. All I can speak is to what the parties agreed to in this particular contract. If Dove thought that was an unreasonable and excessive amount to ask for, they could have said no. They could have negotiated a different amount. They could have done any host of things before they gave us their commitment that's what they would pay if they breached the agreement. I'd like to address a point that the Chief Justice brought up. As far as it relates to, if this was an action against the employees, if we're here to talk about whether or not I could, as a matter of public policy, enforce this contract to prohibit an employee from working. I think the outcome of this case may be different. But what we're talking about here is enforcing a contract between two businesses that freely entered into it. And I think you also, in weighing public policy concerns, you need to weigh the public policy of this state as far as enforcing contracts. And under Dannon and Jansen, if it's not really similar, but if you draw an analogy to the economic loss doctrine, I mean, here you're talking about allocating risks, as it was talked about a little bit earlier. I mean, you have two business entities who are entering into a contract who are trying to decide what the proper cost for providing services are going to be. And I think the law and the public policy on contract law is designed to protect the expectancy interests of the parties to privately bargain for agreements. And what you have here is an agreement, and they're trying to use maybe a better public policy, if I was trying to enforce this as to employees, is that we are required to give them notice. But under the facts, and again, I hate to bring you back to the record of this case here, under the record of the case here, it didn't matter at all. And what Dove is trying to do is to use a public policy argument that doesn't really affect the employees in reality in this case, and use that as an excuse to get out of paying for a fee that they freely negotiated, freely entered into, and voluntarily assumed the obligation to pay.
Well, how do we really know it doesn't affect the employees in this case? The employees are not parties. They've never had an opportunity to make a case.
Dove hired them.
Well, the point I'm making is your constant refrain is that the employees are not affected. I don't see anything in this record that indicates that an employee's had an opportunity to say, hey, yeah, I wanted to go to here or to there or wherever, and I couldn't because they told me no.
If you look at the record of each of the employees testified in the trial here, and there is nothing, I would agree with you, there's nothing in the record from any of these employees that say that it affected them either positively or negatively. I think all you can do is go back to the fact that Dove hired them, that they're working, or that they were, at least at the time all of this happened, they were working at the Dove facility. So there's nothing in the record that says that it did adversely affect them either.
Well, it affects the employees as a practical matter by inflating the cost of hiring them, right? And thereby creates something of a disincentive to do so. But I suppose amortized over the duration of the employee's stay at the new employer, that may or may not make a difference.
And that's right. And if Dove chose, in recognizing those costs and that expense, if Dove had made the choice not to hire these employees because of that cost, that's a decision every business will face when making hiring decisions. Whether or not the person is willing or is worth what it's going to take you to get them in the door and pay them as compensation. And in this case, Dove felt that these employees were worth it. I point out that there was nothing that prohibited Dove from going and hiring anyone else here.
Counsel, you're not asking, let me ask, are you asking that these employees be fired?
No.
You're asking for the 50% monetary damage
exactly. Only,
and nothing with regard to the hiring or not hiring or firing of these individuals.
Correct.
If that's all you're asking, then why is this issue not moot? You're not seeking relief with regard to that provision of the contract.
Because Dove won't pay the money that the trial court said they should pay because the Court of Appeals said they don't have to. So the reason that I'm here is because I think the Court of Appeals was wrong, and I think that my client is entitled to the benefit of the bargain that they negotiated with Dove, and they're entitled to their money.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Thank you, Ms. Dittmer, for an unusual case raising both the Sherman Act and the restrictive covenant that keeps her.